I have a lot of very strong beliefs, and I'm really willing to go to bat based on those beliefs.
Could you take us on the journey of how you got
the thing
here?
That I learned about being a producer? Kind of,
whatever it's taken to get to this point.
A completely different perspective.
Wow. That's my job.
Producing Heroes, a Circa podcast. Hi, it's Yaron, and thanks for joining us to meet today's producing hero, Ruth Wickler. Ruth is Deputy Program Director at La Tohu, Montreal's dedicated circus venue. With her organization Boom, she has brought genre-busting performances to Oregon, where she is, I believe, for this conversation.
Correct.
Ruth, welcome. Is there a narrative to a career that spans underground performances from all the corners of the world through to circus in Montreal?
So, it really is about artistic form and a certain personal obsession that I've had since I was a teenager about how artistic form can respond to historical and social contexts. So that sounds very theoretical, but actually it has borne out over these many, many years. And essentially, when I discovered contemporary circus, which was in the context of a street theater festival in Colombia, in 1997, when I was there on tour with the San Francisco Mime Troupe, I discovered contemporary circus and thought, you know, this art form has so much, it's so malleable and it's so awkward and it's so playful and it so has no rules that I thought, you know, just like Brecht did with theater in another era, and just like the theater troupe I was on tour with at that time, the San Francisco Mime Troupe did for the 1960s, I thought, you know, contemporary circus has the possibility to be messed with and reinvented to respond to our times. Now, this is something that occurred to me. Now it's been a while, so that's old news. But it did get me onto the circus bandwagon and got me jumping into creating circus and making circus dramaturgy and doing producing. And that combined with my equal obsession, which has been international arts exchange for many, many years, those two things have been my two kind of guiding narratives actually since then, and various kinds of jobs and non-jobs and researches and creations and producing and all that. Pretty much two-track mind, I suppose, all the way to now.
And how does it work being constantly across cultures and genres? Like, nothing that you've said in your career narrative involves things just by themselves. Like, you've got contemporary and circus, and you've got international and exchange, and you currently work in Montreal and kind of in Oregon, and you're kind of working in Francophone and English. Like essentially, are you a professional bridge?
Actually, yes. The fact that I can, I actually have multiple diplomats in my family on multiple generations going back, and the ability to surf and navigate between mindsets and between languages and between cultures and between art forms is very much DNA. There you go. Baked in. That sort of my little special skill is that I speak a lot of languages, but also it's not just speaking languages. It's also being able to kind of adapt to different environments, meld in, but also empathize with where I'm at to the degree to understand how something might fit in. So in the work of international presenting, which is what I'm currently doing with La Tohu, that's exactly what curatorial practice is, in fact, is to say we're not all the same. And what does it mean to bring this artwork from one context to another? And to also understand that not everything is made to move across cultures, and some things don't do it so well, and some things do it brilliantly. One thing I think in circus particularly, that it can be a little deceiving, a little deceptive, because circus has so many attributes that could be regarded as universal. You know, so in fact, it does travel really well across cultures compared to much more culturally specific or communication-based art forms. But at the same time, it is still an international exchange practice that merits being recognized as such too.
Tell us about the kind of theater that attracted you. Did it have similar qualities to those you loved in contemporary circus?
The work that I curated in Oregon was certainly, I would say there were some projects that had more traditional dramaturgy. And those projects actually were the most international. So the thing that was strange about those was the culture that they came from, the cultural context and things, that even just the act of bringing a play from Uganda or a play from India into a, you know, America's 23rd largest city cultural context was as strange enough for the art form itself not to be completely buck wild, you know. But some of the more kind of experimental versions of theater that I curated that were by American artists really crossed forms. The word theater in its broadest sense of really hybrid performance, mixing all things together. So certainly I have avoided the absolute straight down the line dramaturgy, let's say.
There's absolutely nothing straight down the line about anything that you've done. I mean, your circus creations seem to combine a very unlikely bunch of bedfellows, including fin de siècle French operetta, 19th century American poetry, and 16th century drawings. What were you thinking? Where did these ideas come from? What was behind them?
Actually, there's the bridge thing, which you named, which I feel like you know me very well. But the bridging aspect of, you know, what would happen if we put this and this together. So in a way, it's synthesis and the idea of putting two unlikely things in a pot and mixing them up and having that be the motor for generating something new. But then there's also just there's a bit of laziness also, which is to say, actually, my creativity comes from synthesis rather than origination. And to say, listen, there's dig deep into the annals of art history of any discipline, and you have these incredible gems that don't get a lot of play, and they were already created. So let's draw on them to fuel whatever we're making. And that's just my particular type of creativity, is finding and mixing. But I have to say that the idea, you know, one project that I was super proud of was making a circus out of Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman and producing it in Brooklyn, right near the Brooklyn Bridge. And basically each of the circus acts that I commissioned from different circus artists to go with a certain poem. And then the poem was read while the piece was performed. You know, these generated beauty that would never have come out of the straight, you know, the single discipline. It was certainly, and you know, you never heard what Whitman performed like that, you know. So it was definitely mutually beneficial.
Reflecting through your career, what has been the relationship between the ideas you've had and the ideas of others that you've enabled, and which ones have turned out better?
Well, when I explain to students how I found my comfort zone as a producer, I talk about, you know, I started as an actress. I started acting when I was 8. And then, you know, later on, I realized that, you know, acting, you were just focused on yourself and your role on the stage. And then I started directing. So then I got to be in charge of what was going on the stage in its totality. But then I started producing, and then I was in charge of the connection between the totality of what happened, of the artwork and the audience. And certainly curating and producing hand in hand have been about that connection between the audience and the artist. And it has given me great joy to cede those other roles to the brilliance of others. And actually I find it is really that bridging thing. So like I love this moment of connection between artist and audience, and I consider that my specialty. And when I delve deeper into that through contextual programming or through talkbacks or, you know, engagement work or whatever it is, that is all to deepen that same experience and to further help, support the vision of the artist that's on stage. It gives me great, great pleasure, and I actually feel no envy or it's actually the perfect place for me.
That is welcome to the ears of many an artist, but the reverse side of that is that you and I both have the privilege of not being 18 and having traveled around the world and having seen a lot of stuff and having been involved in thousands, tens of thousands of conversations. And many artists think that their ideas are completely original and startlingly good, and often they're not. I'd love you to talk me through the experience of how do you guide an artist as a producer towards originality, towards vigorous visions that may actually cause you grief but might produce work of, you know, searing brilliance. How do you do that when someone, an artist you believe in, brings something okay or done before or to you? Have you been in that situation?
I guess that I don't feel like I'm the expert on this one. I'm not that old. but I will say that my advice always is to be true to yourself and make the thing that you were destined to make, and then to try and fail and try and fail and fail and fail and fail. Ultimately, somebody making a work, you know, one mistake that I see is someone who makes a work and hasn't failed enough, and so tries to build the one thing they tried, you know. So it seems to me like the trying and the failing and the trying and the failing is the kind of way to, you know, find your voice. That sounds really cliche, though. I'm not sure I want to put that on the record.
No, as somebody who has failed amply, I heartily concur. I think the way you make good stuff is to make an awful lot of not good stuff. I'd be interested if you could talk us through a project. If you could talk us through a project that really worked and exceeded your expectations, and a project that got away from you.
I tell you a project that I was so proud of that happened just now. It happened in February. It was a big project that we did at Tohu. The opportunity was that we had received, the Tohu had received a grant for a project, and that the project that it was, that the grant was destined for had fallen through. And so it was up to me after I had arrived there to help to develop the replacement and get it passed by the grantors. And what we put together was a month-long project that included basically the Tohu's first ever presentation of an African circus troupe. So this was from Morocco. A two-week run at Tohu, which is no small thing, especially for the first time that a company has come, plus visits to three different cities in Canada with a mixture of performances and engagement work with connecting with circus communities in all the three cities, and plus a kind of full-on contextual / cultural engagement / outreach project during the Montreal period. So this was all built around this lovely performance by the Groupe Acrobatique de Tanger, which was a very sweet, spectacular, impressive group acrobatic performance that included poetry and music, live music, and cultural references here a lot, and lovely. It's beautifully authentic, and also some moments of the very acrobatic prowess and everything, basically lovable by absolutely everyone of all ages and from all backgrounds. And this for me was a ambitious project in the sense that it was larger, you know, the scope was bigger than what I had ever done in terms of the amplitude of the whole thing, and the achievements that we managed to do really was in the way that the project through our strategies around the cultural engagement work that we did for many, many months beforehand, opened the doors to this institution to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of members of the Moroccan and Maghreb communities in Montreal who had never been to the Tohu before. The place was welcoming and open to them as a result of this. So for me, that was a huge, a beautiful, beautiful thing to orchestrate, be part of, support, etc.
It sounds like a magnificent project. And my follow-up question, based on my theory that in the middle of everything is its opposite, is what did you get spectacularly wrong with that? What was the bit that you messed up?
You know, I think that I have, for many, many years, been an independent producer with my ways of doing things that are you know, don't really follow all the rules. And so the part of the gift to work at this scale in this institutional context was, in fact, the institutional context. And I think if I could do it again, I would have a deeper and more fluency with what that means.
I understand that very well. And I think that the challenge of becoming the Navy when you have been the pirate is incredibly complex and very underrepresented in the literature. I'd like to go into that moment, into that a little later, but first, can we talk about the project that got away from you in some way?
The thing that comes to mind, it's very funny because what I just described was quite large as a project. As I said, the budget was large, the scope was large, the number of people reached, you know, we had thousands and thousands and thousands of people see that work that I just described. So that was, you know, the scale was very large. And when you, I know I've had many of these problems, projects that didn't work, but the one that comes to mind is one event that happened one day that hardly anyone attended. That doesn't mean that larger things haven't worked. Okay, but that's the one that comes to mind when you say this. This was a play that I selected and produced in Portland as part of the Boom Art series. It was so terrible that during the event, I felt like I wanted to dig a hole in the ground and get in there and never, you know, and not come out until everyone had left and forgotten all about it.
That is an indescribable experience, dear listener, when you've programmed or produced or created something and you watch this slow motion train wreck and you know you are responsible and there's nowhere to hide. And if you haven't had that experience in your life, you need to, just so you know how much you never want it to happen
and
again.
And also, I have to say that to me is something you cannot learn in a university arts administration program. Do you know what I mean? The school of hard knocks of, you know, you made a choice and you put it in front of people and people gave you their time to experience it. And it was a terrible, terrible mistake. And just the emotional depth of that regret, remorse. I mean, I suppose it's empathy. You know, I don't have a blasé attitude about it. I certainly was grateful for, I've been grateful for every person who has subjected themselves to something that I have selected or produced and put in front of them. It is a deep gratitude that I have to each person who has said, yes, I will spend my time with what you put into the public arena, or I will spend some money, or I might donate money or any of these things. It's just deep. I feel deeply grateful for that, each person and each ticket and all of this. Which is why that the depth of the feeling of regret in that moment is so bad. And so anyway, among the many things, I fell into my own. I know, you know, another thing is, I think, you know, once you've done this enough, you sort of know your own weaknesses. One of mine is being too theoretical, having a theory. You think theoretically something's going to work, but in practice, it really didn't, and you didn't test it, and so you just flopped. You know, so that happened. It was very. It was a play that was, I picked because of the political subject matter, and it was deeply, deeply sad with no levity. And it was very foreign and totally opaque. And even the artists who were involved in it didn't really get it. And the local collaborations that I had embarked on, all of them flopped, and every single choice that every single person made was really bad. So et cetera, et cetera. it goes down from there.
The thing about train wrecks is that they really are wrecks. But in the middle of that, there would have been some moment, if my theory holds, of success. There would be some moment at something you got fabulously right. It would have been something.
You know, the venue I chose for this was way too big. There weren't enough people. Everything about it was wrong. And there was no, I don't remember. I mean, it was one vaguely positive thing about it, artistically. But it wasn't so positive that I went away feeling like, well, at least this gave me the opportunity to do this. You know what I mean? I'm ready to flush it down the toilet. I really am.
Okay, well, we need not dwell in those misery-filled depths. I'd like to go onto that pirate that turns into the Navy, because I'm interested in what skills you have to learn when you go from being an outside producer to being an inside producer or programmer, and what you miss about the being a pirate.
I'm fortunate to have flip-flopped a couple of times, actually. So when I was producing my independent circuses, that was definitely on the indie side of things, you know, the pirate side. I started doing programming in a university context, and that was, you know, certainly the institutional, the Navy side, and then going back to independent producing, and then now I'm back in institution. I remember moving to this university context. There's a child's book called Eloise, American children's book called Eloise, about Eloise Six. And it's one of my favorites, that she lives at the Plaza Hotel. And when, you know, whenever she has a need for room service, she just calls down to the lobby and she says, you know, I'll have this, 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 and that. And charge it, please. Thank you very much. And then she hangs up the phone. And when I started working in this university environment, I felt like that was what I was doing. I was, you know, getting on the phone and just being like, I'll have, you know, catering and, you know, lights and all these things, and charge it, please. Thank you very much.
It's awesome. Having a budget, like the few times I've had one, is such a great feeling where you can just make things happen.
But certainly the exchange is that there are rules that you need to learn and follow and adhere to it. And in fact, you know, the virtue of the institution is that it's a social compact in which everyone does work together using certain rules, and that's how the whole thing can work, you know, and function. So the challenge of learning those and working effectively within them, I think, is the art form of being effective within an institutional context. And certainly when you're independent, the exchange is a lack of resources and a surplus of freedom.
What's your risk tolerance like?
You know, risk is a big part of my life. It's a big part in all different areas of my life. But, you know, some of these projects that I have, that I end up at the other side of them being incredibly proud of, I would say all the projects that I, on the other side, have ended up being incredibly proud of, have just been gigantically risky. So my ability to not check if the pool has much water in it has caused me a certain amount of grief in the actual experience of something, whether it's overextension or, you know, true failure or all this. And it doesn't mean that every risk has been successful by any means. But on the other side of it, in many cases, I wind up just being so proud of having gone that far out.
I'm passionately interested in what gets people to go beyond the first no. What happens when you get your first no as a producer?
So I would actually, as you were speaking, I thought to myself, you know, I'm sure each person has their own kind of topology of risk aversion and risk susceptibility. Risk appetite and risk aversion. And, you know, no one's 100%. When I say I've risked it all or that kind of thing, it sounds very grandiose. And in fact, when I think about it, there's certain giant categories of the work that I don't risk. I'm very risk averse, financially being a big one. So, you know, I haven't risked it all financially on big things. And I think that has kept my own independent work, fairly smaller scale, actually, than I know other independent producers who don't have as much risk aversion financially as I do and have grown their practice financially much bigger than I. So that's interesting to think about. I think for me, I'm very, like I said, theoretical is one way to say it, but I think values-based or mission-driven is another way of saying it. Like, I have a lot of very strong beliefs, and I'm really willing to go to bat based on those beliefs. And so if, you know, a lot of them link to social justice issues, equity issues, and things like that. And basically, I have a sort of clear sense, deep sense of right and wrong and just and unjust and things like that. And so I'm definitely willing to push past a no if I think that that's one thing that might be fueling a no, for example.
I'm assuming from that conversation, do you find it more exciting to produce projects that are really hard to produce or really easy? Do you like it hard or soft as a producer?
Oh, without saying anything about content, it's impossible for me to answer that. I think that I love producing projects that I believe in. And the more passionate I am about it, the more I'm willing to produce the hell out of it. So a sense of, I don't see it as a neutral question about just the fun of the puzzle, but rather the complexity of a project. Like, I'm willing to bite off much more than I've chewed before if it's a project that I feel is worthy.
So if you're belief driven as you are, how do you deal with the radical encounter with the person who disagrees with you? And it's something that I've been thinking about a lot, because we in the arts seem very good at talking to people who agree with us. And occasionally we stick our heads out of our own amniotic sack and go, wow, there's a whole world out there that just doesn't agree with us. This must intrude I think it intrudes in every producer's lifetime, whether it's in the review we weren't expecting, the protest, the negative feedback, the kind of just the encounter with the people who fundamentally don't agree with the values that have caused the project to happen. Have you had that experience? How have you dealt with it? How has it impacted on you personally?
Well, I would say that in those contexts, I draw on my bridge / diplomatic skills, certainly to how to navigate those. But I also think that I know others who do that much better than I will say.
How much of the risk in producing is emotional?
For me, it's a lot. And I think it's because the whole world of performing arts, especially in the US, especially in underfunded contexts where you have to really struggle, and every person who comes to see something is a person that you cannot take for granted. Certain contexts, none of it you can take for granted, because there, very few cultural environments, I would say, in the US that I've experienced, just have the audience just flowing in. And I think that's probably because I've worked in more provocative, difficult art forms and things. And also working in Portland, particularly not a city that has the audience is not enormous for performing arts compared to, much larger environments. Anyway, so I think because I haven't been able to take it for granted, projects become passion projects, and passion projects by definition have an emotional component to them. So, I remember a project. So sometimes as an independent producer or curator, I would struggle very hard to bring a project to Portland, and it would fall through because of resources, or because we would negotiate. And for whatever reason, it just wouldn't end up happening. And I remember giving up on a certain project with a producer colleague who I respect greatly. And she said to me, it's important to recognize when when it pushes past the point of being pleasurable, or that it's time to give up on something. She said, we kill ourselves over every project anyway, at least in the spheres that I've worked in. And actually, it's interesting, with Tohu is a large institution with great standing, but circus is not everyone's main dish of choice culturally. So even in a larger institution like that, they still work hard for each audience member, and to say, and also the particular challenge of presenting circus throughout the year and in the summer, it tests people's appetite for one art form that doesn't, there aren't that many people who can say, who maybe there are people who work in the circus field, but for those who don't, how much appetite do you have for this one art form throughout the year, you know? So even though they have a beautiful institutional base or foundation, you know, they are very valued by the city, by the province, and by the country, very high standing culturally and everything like that. We still fight for each audience member. It still feels like an emotional process to select the work and to entice the people to come and all these things, even though the secret for circus is that actually people love it once they see it.
A young producer comes and says, what do I need to know? I want to head into the world and make stuff happen. What advice can you give me?
I think my response would be that the things that I've seen motivate brilliant producers that I know have been a true passion for artists and following artists and supporting artists. And then at the same time, like me, I would say I have that also, but I also have this sort of, you know, passion for the audience artist connection. And those are both motivators that also are about following, tracking, nurturing. You know, it's a lot of the brilliant producers I know have a sort of slightly maternal nurturing aspect of what they do. And so finding out why you would do this, who are the artists that inspire and make you passionate about wanting to support them? What are the values that make you want to give yourself over to something like this? What about the moment of encounter between artists and audiences brings you, makes you alive? It's this position that is behind the scenes, and it's very, I won't say, I was going to say selfless, but I think it's a reciprocal. I certainly gain from the joy that I experience when it works. So it feeds me for sure. But finding the why behind it first, when I see, especially independent producers who I respect greatly, they all have a very clear sense of that, why they're doing it, who inspires them, both artists and audience. It's not super cerebral. You know, I was saying earlier that at my worst, I'm too theoretical, but sometimes the word curator can seem like a, you know, art history curator or things, it can be very, it can get into abstraction very quickly. And I used to call myself curator and producer, and the role of producer seems to me to be much less cerebral and in fact more about this symbiosis between the producer and the person or the work or the audience who you're supporting.
Are there any golden producing moments that you come back to, particularly when times get difficult?
Well, when I was doing my producing in Oregon, each of the projects that I produced, Boomeritz is a series, performance series that didn't have a venue. So each project was, you know, yes, it was a season, but nobody really needed it to exist. And it took place in lots of different environments. And so it was very bespoke and very much curator's choice kind of a deal. And one project that felt in a way like one of the riskiest things I had done, in fact, I remember one project that felt just incredibly, I remember opening night, pacing around behind the audience members with this kind of my stomach all in knots and not knowing what people were going to absorb about it or not. And that project being one of these projects that on the other side of it, I felt so proud of, which had a very sweet component. So basically, this was a monologue by a Argentine Spanish playwright, which on its surface was about a man who found himself at the end of his rope, having saved up money over his life, but not having had it amount to very much, and his decision to blow it all on one crazy night, which he describes in great detail, in which he ends up, this fantasy he has, ends up at the Prado Museum in Madrid, looking at Goya's black paintings. And the whole performance is him sort of describing what that's going to be like and how the kind of apex moment is him arriving at these paintings, which I later went to the Prado to see, and they are quite extraordinarily dark.
The dog is on my fridge. it's an the drowning dog. It's extraordinary. It's the image that every producer should acquaint themselves with.
I had seen a rendition of this done in London by a young director whose brilliant idea was to, you know, the guy's adventure is he brings his sons on this adventure with him and he narrates that. And so the young director whose production of this I had seen had decided to cast these non-speaking roles of the sons as live piglets. And so this became my challenge. I brought her to Oregon to restage this, and this became my challenge of the search for the piglets. And this is one of the sweet, sweet memories that I have, which was showing up in the Oregon County Fair and asking a 4-H student where I could find a pig farmer who might be willing to rent me some piglets. And this girl is being like, oh yeah, just right over there. You know, she knew exactly who it was. So I remember going over to the guy and saying, you know, do you have any piglets you might be willing to rent to me? And him saying, oh yeah, well, actually we have rented piglets out for calendars and that kind of thing in the past. And just the journey of going to the pig farm to meet the mom pig and seeing how pigs are inseminated and things, which happens with a lot of human intervention using hands and things like that. And then, seeing all these suckling piglets and then getting to hold the piglets that would be coming to our production. And this journey with the piglets. And then the fact that I found a wrangler who was a theater student who also happened to have been a 4-H person in high school. And she became our pig wrangler and she hosted the pigs at her home in a little hut in her garage or something like that. And then having to build these little fences for the piglets and finding out that the piglets were very sensitive to light and they were sensitive to the lines in the show. And so when at first they would stay in their little tub until their cue, which was a light and speech cue. And then after a while, they realized that we had made this rule of not bringing them out. If they made some scuffle, that the actor would bring them out of the tub and let them run around. And so they started doing that earlier and earlier in the thing. And so eventually they just completely took over the thing. And then also they got so big between the performances that they actually broke the little fence. And then they shat so much, Yaron, that the actors spent half the time cleaning up pig shit. And then there was this part where, you know, he eats spam sausages in front of them, you know, in the reference to the Goya painting of the what's his face eating his children. And, you know, there were people walking out at that time because they were for animal rights. And it was just like, do you think the pigs really understand that, you know, someone is eating sausage? Anyway, these are just, you know, there are a million of these little stories that I hold like little, I feel like when I get old and I need to sit around having memories, I have many of these. Each of these are so rich and beautiful. I feel very grateful for them. But I'm sure that we all have these stories. You know, we all have these little stories and these little beautiful memories. And I, in the context of getting, you know, having a lovely interview where you're asking me questions, I get to tell you this. But we all have these, you know, all the producers, we all have these, you know, bouquets.
Ruth, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. I'm Yaron Lifshitz, and you've been listening to Producing Heroes, a Circa podcast, produced by Lauren Isaacson. If you've been listening on Apple Podcasts, please consider writing a review. And if you like what you've heard, you can find us on social media at Circa Contemporary Circus, #ProducingHeroes.